On today's episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, we're going to be talking about how to create training screencasts for your VAs, subscription billing, launch day tactics, and answering more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 91. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What is the word this week, sir?
So I have my first official early access customer for Audit Shark, and I'm in the middle of trying to get a conversation going with a Fortune 500 company who might be willing to give it a try.
Nice. What does might be willing to give it a try mean? Did they contact you? Have you approached them? What's been the conversation?
Somebody gave me an introduction. It was just an introduction. We haven't actually discussed anything, but he said that it was via email that my product sounded interesting. So he kind of wanted to hear a little bit more about it. So I sent him some more details via email, and we're just trying to sync up right now on a good time to chat over the phone to discuss what their needs are around the product and whether or not it's a good fit. And if so, then maybe we can work something out where they'll sign onto the early access program and go from there.
Cool. And then you said you have your first official early access customer. So that's someone who's agreed to kind of be like a pre-beta?
Yep. We'll see how that goes. I already had a phone discussion with that person, and you know, they've got a bunch of servers that they want to start auditing, and discussed exactly how it works and the fact that it's essentially a one-click option is kind of the selling point for them. I mean, they were looking for easy, and the way that I presented it and the way that it's going to be presented in the software is when you sign up, you really don't have to do much other than install the software on your servers, and it just automatically goes and starts doing its thing for them and shows you things that it thinks you should do something about.
Right. So is it true that we are now 5 weeks away from the Audit Shark beta?
Yeah, from the early access, yes. And I've got 2 weeks off at the end of August to essentially kind of buckle down and make sure that everything's going well and starting to get excited about it. We'll see how things go.
Cool. Looking forward to it. So I have been scaling up my ad buys. I've been doing mega paid acquisition for
really
retail customers. Yeah.
Isn't that what we advocate against?
No, actually, well, that's the thing is, once your lifetime value is high enough, if you can find streams that will scale that have low enough cost per acquisition, then I'm a hearty advocate of anything that gets you new customers for a lot less than they are worth to you during their lifetime.
You sound like a venture capitalist.
Yeah, right. It's like plug money in this side, more money comes out the other side. It's been fun, though. In the past, I've done all, you know, the gamut, the Google AdWords and the Facebook and all that stuff, and I've had success with it, but not to this degree. I think Hittail is just at a different level. I mean, Hittail is it's a different app. It's a different animal than most of the stuff I've done in the past in terms of size. So it's nice to be somewhat horizontal, but what I found is that when I target things out of a niche where people are going to know what SEO is automatically, the conversion rate's terrible. And it's not that I couldn't educate them, but it's that they're not going to click through and sign up for a trial for something they don't just get right away. So at this point, the conversion rates are quite good when I stick to people who are already knowledgeable about SEO topics.
Now, does that direct your paid acquisition strategy in terms of who you're targeting?
Absolutely. So I'm doing, you know, both banner ads through buy-sell ads. I'm probably using six different networks right now with varying degrees of success. And it's pretty obvious. I mean, you know, when you do this stuff, man, you got to get the goal tracking in there. You need to use the Google URL creator that allows you to see specifically which ads are performing better for you. So even though I probably have 25 different ads running right at this minute, and I'm constantly cycling them in and out, I know which ones, not only which ones are sending me traffic, but which ones are actually converting into trials. And that is absolutely critical. It sounds like a no-brainer, right? But it's a bit of work to set that up, but it just makes it so I can now turn off all the ones that aren't working and just basically 10x my spend on the ones that are working.
That's cool. So hopefully the 10x spend will equate to 10x sales, but
So far, I haven't 10x'd. I've 3x'd since I started, and it has allowed 3x the trials. So, you know, it's a 30-day trial, so I don't actually know. I mean, I know my standard trial to paid conversion, and assuming that holds true, I'm doing pretty good. So I'm happy with it. I'll put it that way. It's nice to find something that's somewhat scalable. I mean, I have this, you know, I've talked a lot about this 11-page marketing plan that I put together, and all that stuff's great, but some of it is stuff that's like infographics and guest blogging and that kind of stuff that just, it's very time intensive. It's not going to let your business basically grow infinitely where you can kind of step back. I have to be involved, even though I'm outsourcing, I outsource the infographics production. I still have to be intimately involved with each of these steps. Paid acquisition, I'm realizing, is a lot more time intensive than I think I'd realized. So I will outsource that eventually, but it is something that I can really outsource and step away. I mean, I could, if I can find someone who can run it well, and I've already started a conversation with someone.
Well, I think you could probably set up parameters around that such that if it dips below a certain point, then
absolutely,
you just say, look, we got to pull the plug on this, but, you know, just kind of set those numbers out there and either publish them to the person who you put in charge of it, or you just kind of watch them outside of that.
No, that's absolutely the guy I'm talking to. I basically am like, here's my cost per acquisition I can go to. Here's what I need for, you know, here's what I can pay for a trial. Here's what I've been getting for clicks. I showed them everything I've been doing because I want them to take that and then expound upon it and do a better job with it.
Are you using Google AdWords at all for that?
So that's the kicker, right? You would think that Google AdWords would be the best thing. They won't allow me to send traffic from AdWords because we guarantee that you will that you'll get an increase in search traffic, and we'll refund your money if you don't. But they're like, nope, you can't do that. You can't make in the email, it's called site policy. You can't make outlandish claims about guaranteed. And it's boilerplate, right? They didn't write it specifically for my site, but I mean, they're obviously guarding against like these fly by night internet marketers. Stuff, and they're like, you have to include what the average person or what the typical result is. And I wrote back and I'm like, well, the typical result is that people increase their organic search traffic, like I said. And they're like, well, you can't guarantee that without like a big asterisk and some other stuff. So at this point, frankly, I'm not, the site converts really well the way it is. And I'm not about to start messing with headlines just to get AdWords traffic yet, because I have other sources that are working well enough. So I'm going to stick to those, focus to those, and you focus on them. And if I burn through them, then I'll look at, you know, messing with my site. But that's a whole other deal, right? Then I have to test headlines and make sure the conversion rates stay. And there's a lot of work to go into there. So I don't just want to start messing with it because Google asked me to.
It's too bad that you're not using Google AdWords for that, because I was going to thank you for the check that I got from Google.
What'd they send you?
So I got, Google had some class action lawsuit against them for AdWords, but I have a check like in my hands from Google for some AdWords that I'd done a few years ago. And it says, paid to the order of Moon River Software, $0.17.
Now you can get that operation you've always wanted.
It just boggles my mind that they have to send me a check for less than it costs to probably send this. The other thing I've got going on is I'm relaunching my Altiris training website this coming Monday. I talked a little bit about that probably about 2 months ago or so.
So Altiris is software that Symantec builds, right?
Yep. So I do a lot of consulting around that. And a long time ago, I said, wow, you know, it'd be really nice if I could kind of translate this knowledge and not actually have to go talk to people and instead just either have them subscribe to a newsletter or mailing list or video website or something like that. So a couple of months ago, I had mentioned that I was messing around and accidentally launched a new product. And I had put the Altiris Training website out there. I'd recorded a couple of videos, but hadn't done anything too serious with it. And over the course of probably about a month to a month and a half, I'd kind of done all of the analysis of the niche and said, okay, well, how much traffic do I expect to get? What's my sign up rate going to be? And I figured that I'd only get a couple of hundred visits per month. So it seemed kind of low to me. I wasn't real sure whether or not that would really get any traction or that people would, you know, really start converting very well for it. And what I found was I actually got a fair number of people signing up for it. It was actually probably about 2 to 3 times what I had expected, and people were paying me money, and which every single person I had to refund their money because I really didn't have a full-blown website for them. So what I did was I sat down for about 8 hours and scoped out an entire site design and handed it off to a developer who implemented it. And everything's kind of coming together right now. I've got Wistia on the back end to run all the videos and do the analysis for the content that people are viewing. And I'm going to be sending off an Excel spreadsheet to my VA here pretty soon. And she's going to go upload all the videos and put them into Wistia and format them on the website. And hoping by Monday I'll have the website good to go. I've just got to send an email out to the people who've signed up and see if they're willing to basically pay me again, because, again, I had to refund all their money through PayPal. Now I'm doing everything through Stripe because they're a lot better when it comes to subscriptions and dealing with those. I don't know. I'm looking forward to it. Should be pretty good.
You are a shining example of outsourcing. It sounds like you pretty much outsourced everything except for making the videos.
Yeah, the videos themselves, I spent some time doing them. I'm trying to think. I'm up to 19 videos now. I should have 30 by Monday. And of those 19 videos, I've spent 3 to 4 hours setting up the environment to create the videos. And then after that, I probably spent maybe 4 hours for those 20 videos. And like my time to record is going down dramatically for each video. I mean, some of them, it's just one pass through and boom, I'm done. So in a 3-minute video, it takes me 4 minutes to actually record it because I just have to double check some things. But yeah, I mean, the vast majority of this thing has been outsourced. I haven't done hardly anything for it.
Sweet. Well, good luck with the launch. Just a couple days away.
I'll definitely keep everyone posted on how that's going. I mean, I look at it as a way to short-term kind of get me out of consulting. Once I get far enough along with AutoShark, I'll probably look to start selling it because I don't really want to be creating these Altiris videos every week.
Right. So you see it as building an asset for now to generate some income, but it's not a passion thing. And
yeah.
Late down the line, once you've left consulting and that kind of stuff, AutoShark takes off, or your next project. Cool. I have 3 quick things I want to run through. One is Hittail update. July was the best month ever for Hittail. It actually grew by several $1,000 in recurring revenue per month. And that there were a bunch of things that went on in June that sent a ton of trials, and then they all converted in July. So that was, it wasn't news. I knew that was going to happen, but I was very excited to see the numbers grow. I also had someone ordered $1,000 worth of articles.
Wow.
From me. Yeah. And then my margin's 50. It's about 50%. I was shocked. He emailed me directly and said, hey, I want 66 articles, whatever the number was. And, he asked for a quote and stuff, and I had my VA get it done. So it was, that was part of it, right? That was part of why the bump will be big and, won't necessarily be in August, but it was a nice one. So Hittail is scheduled to pay back its original purchase price in August, assuming I have, close to the month that I had in July.
Cool.
Yeah. So it's cool. That doesn't include improvements, obviously all the time and money I've spent since then, but it's just the original purchase price itself.
Right. Now, did you ever end up landing that enterprise customer that you talked about? You did a lot of, a foreign character.
Chinese SEO. So no, I didn't. And I'm still emailing with him. It's been 2 months probably. And I email with him and he says, oh, we just, it's typical, right? It's a long sales cycle thing. I mean, it's an expensive account. And he says, yes, I really want to try it out, but other things are going on. Now, I have been in talks with 2 or 3 other enterprise customers. For me are enterprise customers. They're low triple digits per month. That's fairly exciting because Hittail is, typically a $10, $20, $40 a month plan. I've been in contact with 3 of them. I had a phone call with one of them. So there is some, kind of medium touch sales going on here, which is totally worth it once you get above that $99 price point per month. So I'm excited about, none of them have converted. I had verbal commitments from 2 of them. One guy's like, yes, we're going with it. Just have to, get it through and get the code installed and all this other stuff, but no money as of yet, but that'll be nice. That'll be a nice little bump when it comes through.
Cool.
Second thing is, if you haven't checked out TechZing episode 200, they did a special episode. They got the TechZing wives on the show to tell all. It was hilarious. And it was just Justin's wife, Jason's wife, and actually my wife. They got Sherry on there. So the 3 of them just have a blast talking and kind of roasting their husbands. It's pretty cool. So yeah, I definitely recommend it. I just listened to it yesterday. I was dying. There's some pretty funny moments that I think will all resonate with us.
You didn't get to the control over any sort of the editing process?
No. And I listened to some of it and I was like, oh, I can't believe she said that. One of the things Jason's wife, Sandy, said was that he's into The Bachelorette. And she's like, he's going to kill me for saying that. And I was like, yes. If you look at the actual comments on the episode on TechZingLive.com, there are some other cool summarizations of the funny moments, but definitely worth a listen. It's, as usual, it's an hour and 45 minutes or whatever, but it's a good one. The last thing is, I stumbled upon this show on Hulu, but it's called Startup Junkies, and it follows Earth Class Mail. It's like a reality show following the inner workings of Earth Class Mail getting started and raising funding. It's pretty friggin' interesting. And I think they're like 30-minute shows and there's only 8 episodes. So I don't know if you need Hulu Plus to watch it or if you can watch it with the non-paid plan. But again, it's not something you watch to like learn, to actually learn actionable tips. It's just entertaining and it's cool to see the stuff they're going through and how they have to define everything. Like they're just in phone conversation talking about venture capitals and then like this pop-up pops onto the screen and it says venture capital, colon, funding raised from people who want a high rate of return. You know, they have to kind of make it layperson appropriate.
Layperson so. Friendly. Yeah. Interesting.
We have a bazillion questions. Questions seem to be coming in faster than we can answer them. So we've stopped answering all the questions on the air. Some of them we answer via email. I did want to ask folks, when you send a question in, try to make it as detailed as possible while keeping brevity in mind. So keep it short, but keep it detailed. Because I'm finding as I'm listening back to some of our answers, we have to say, well, the guy didn't say what business he's in. Because if you're selling like beach towels, or if you're selling software, or if you're selling an info product, the answer really is different. So the more detail you can give us, the less we have to kind of hee and haw and say, it depends on this, this, that, and this. I'm finding that a lot of the questions we're getting really do lack in some key details. Just wanted to ask for that. I think it's beneficial both to us and to the listeners and people asking the questions if you can give us more info. First question is called Sample Screencast, and it says, it's from Justin, and he says, what does your explanatory screencast look like? He's talking about for virtual assistants. Can you post a small sample or perhaps make a screencast on how to make a screencast? So I don't think we're going to make a screencast on how to do that, but you and I both created a lot of screencasts to show VAs how to do a simple process. And sometimes it's a process they'll do over and over. Sometimes it's just a one-time process. You want to talk through briefly how you've gone about that?
Sure. So typically, if it's you want to do these for repeatable tasks or things that you're going to have one person do over and over again, or there are additional details that are probably going to get lost, if it's something you can explain to somebody in just one paragraph, then chances are good you probably don't need a screencast for it. But if it's something that is going to take you several minutes to kind of walk somebody through, then it's worth making a screencast. So what you'll want to do is you'll want to walk through the entire screencast and actually do it. I use Camtasia Studio to do the recordings for these things, and it works out really well. You can just upload the videos directly from Camtasia into screencast.com. Screencast.com has a free account that allows you up to, I think, 2 gigs worth of videos. And then beyond that, I think you get 25 gigs for, I don't know what it is. It's like $50 a year or something like that. It's not real expensive. But then you can separate them out into folders, and you give some people access to some videos and other people access to other videos. But what you're looking for when you're going through these videos and creating them is that you essentially want to walk them through the entire process of what it is they're doing and provide commentary on why. And the why part tends to be much more helpful when you're going through specific details. So, for example, if it's very important when you're, let's say you're doing a logging bugs or working with bugs in fog bugs, for example, when you're talking somebody through that, you not only explain what you want them to do, but why. And the why part is important because it gives them a reference framework for why they're doing something. So, for example, if setting the priority is important to you, then say, don't just say set the priority. Say set the priority to X and because, so that you can list things in order, because maybe that's the way that you work. You want to give them that additional detail to let them know why it's important to you that it is done that way. Just telling somebody to do something, if they forget it and then you have to remind them, and if you're going back and forth through email, it can be a little bit off-putting from their perspective. But when they're hearing your voice say, and I need you to set the priority based on, you know, however important it is, because I use the priority field to sort things and determine what things I should work on next. So if it's really important, set it to 1. If it's not so important, set it to 6, or somewhere in between, obviously set it in between. And then I'll use that as a reference for, you know, how important it is that I get to that in a timely fashion. And if it's a 6, it can probably wait a few days. If it's a 1, I need to respond to it right away. So giving the person that you're giving those things to, that point of reference is really, really important. And again, them hearing it in your own words is much, much better than just putting it in an email, because with an email, you don't get the voice intonations where it can be a little off-putting depending on how it's phrased.
Absolutely. So I find that there are three types of screencasts I create. The first one is typically an overview screencast. And so if I hire a new VA, a new developer, I want them to have a high-level view of what the app is that they're working on. So I've done this for all of them, .NET Invoice, the Academy, Hittail. You know, anytime I hire someone, I just start at the basics. Here is what this app is. Here's what it does. You can go to this URL to see it. Like they need to just get the general idea. Even if they're just a VA answering support emails or a developer just writing code on one section, it helps to have big picture stuff. So typically those wind up being about 10 minutes long. Some of them, I created one for a developer where I walk through Hittail and then I walk through the actual code base briefly. And I showed him what these folders are unnecessary for what you're doing, blah, blah, blah. And he wrote back and he said, this is the best overview I've ever had. I wish all my clients did this. And I know that because I've been a consultant, right? You get brought into a project and you're like, you're totally disoriented because you don't even understand not just the architecture, but like folder locations. And there's so many little nuances that you don't want to read a 10-page doc to get, and that sitting there and watching a 15-minute screencast is super efficient. It's efficient for me to create. It's efficient for him to watch to get an overview. And like you said, the nuances of language and the nuances of intonation, you can kind of say stuff like, you know what? I don't really know what this is for. And that's okay to say in a screencast, whereas you're probably not going to put that into like a doc. The second type of screencast I create is for recurring tasks. And those ones I tend to create it, and that'll be typically between 1 and 5 minutes. Then I will try to put some bullets into a Google Doc so that because they're going to need to refer back to this in the future, and they're not always going to want to watch the screencast over and over. And what I'll tell them in the screencast is, here's the Google Doc. Please update this Google Doc, share between the two of us. Update it as you find new things, if you think the screencast says something that I've missed in the doc, update it. So that's kind of a living document. And then there are definitely one-time tasks that I pass off. That's typically a lot of research stuff, organization, and that one-off, when I got the $1,000 article order, I just popped in, I created a 2-minute screencast. Here's what you're going to need to do. Here's how to do it. I didn't even create a Google Doc accompanying it because it's like that. The screencast explain everything and email me if you have questions. It literally is just a few minutes of you walking through, talking fast, and stepping through the different steps you're doing it, totally unedited, because only one person is ever going to watch it. And so it does not need to be professional at all. And I've also found I use Camtasia. It uploads right into screencast.com, and that is by far the fastest way to do it. And it allows me to make a 60-second or 45-second screencast and have it be worth my time rather than rendering it to the hard drive and then FTPing somewhere and uploading it and finding the URL. I mean, that stuff, it doesn't sound like a lot of time, but when it's a super quick screencast, it just is a non-starter. It doesn't make sense to do. So cool. I hope that helps. I've titled this one, Which Subscription Billing System Should I Use? And it's from Alan Sanchez. He says, first of all, you guys have been such an inspiration. Whenever I'm doubting myself or at a loss of what to do next in my work on my SaaS app, I just go back to your podcast and get recharged. Since you guys are working on subscription-based web apps, what billing systems or services do you use and recommend? From your experience, is it better to hack it in-house against a payment gateway that has a recurring payment API like PayPal, or go with a billing service and not worry about it? What are the advantages and disadvantages? I know billing services take care of PCI compliance and chargebacks, etc. In my case, I'm mostly leaning towards billing services like Chargeify, Recurly, Spreedly, Cheddargetter, etc. When it's time to deal with that later on and decide which one is best for my case. I remember you guys somewhat touched on this in previous webcasts, specifically on whether to go with a percentage transaction fee service or by the number of customers. Looking forward to more of your podcast. More power. Thanks, Alan.
So my thoughts on this are that when you're taking a look at things like, as you mentioned, Chargeify, Recurly, Spreedly, Cheddargetter, and I'll throw in Stripe as well, I don't think that it actually matters. And the reason I don't think it matters is, especially if you're looking at this specifically from a price standpoint, the fact is that you're really talking about percentages or variations between the costs that are really, really small. And if you spend more than, 30 seconds trying to think about which one you should be using, then you probably spent too much time.
Chargeify, Recurly, Spreedly, and Cheddargetter are recurring billing services where you can create plans. They have like a layer built on top of their API, right? They have subscription billing, and then you can create plans, and you basically redirect from your app to their website, and they handle everything. Stripe is a little bit different. Right. They do have a subscription billing system, but it's all API based. And so I agree with what you've said so far, but I did want to, like, Stripe and PayPal are different than those other four recurring services.
Yeah.
I wouldn't group them together. But anyways, keep going with your answer.
Yeah, well, I was just going to essentially say that, you know, you really have to look at the feature set and exactly what you said. I mean, depending on what the feature set that you're looking for and the end user experience. I mean, if you have to redirect the person to somebody else's website, it may be a jarring thing for the end user. It may not be. It depends on how you do that integration and whether or not you're going to put the time and effort into that. But I hear and see a lot of people spending a lot of time looking at the base cost and then the percentages. Well, this person's charging 45 cents plus 2.9% a transaction. This other company, they're only charging 30 cents, but it's 3.5% per transaction. Unless you get to the point where you're charging $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a month, it really doesn't matter. So just kind of ignore those cost things, kind of throw them right out the window, and just pick something that you're comfortable with. The other thing that I would look at is if you're only getting one or two transactions a month, then it may be time to start looking at those things, because sometimes they have like a base cost associated with it, and it is, you know, $30, $40 a month. And if you're only getting one or two customers a month, then you might want to consider looking at another product anyway. But I think that's a separate discussion. But I would take a look at those things. Again, just look at specifically the things that those services are offering, as opposed to looking at how much they're costing you.
Yep, you nailed it. People spend so much time looking at this stuff and spending time on the 2.19 versus 2.29 and trying to eke out every tenth of a percent. And you're right, until you're at 10 or 15 grand a month, it is completely, it isn't worth the time. I had lunch with a founder yesterday who's trying to get his app off the ground. And the advice I gave him was, he asked me this question, what should I do for billing? He's going to use Stripe. That's who I would recommend to go with. But he said they have a subscription API, and we talked through what it would take. And we figured that by the time he's all said and done and tested and everything works, it's going to take somewhere between probably 15 and 20 hours to get it all done. And he is working a full-time job, so he only has about 15 hours a week. And I said, take that week and contact customers and figure out, like, get someone to buy before, because he doesn't have any customers yet, right? And I said, get someone to buy before you even think about doing that. And in the meantime, sign up for either Chargeify, Recurly, Spreadly, or Chattergetter, and use that until you have at least a handful of customers, depending on your price point. Once you know that you have traction, then you switch over to Stripe. You keep your, you know, your old Chargeify, Recurly, Spreadly, Chattergetter account going, and you do have to run two billing systems. You have a few customers on that one who eventually drop out. But to me, to save that 15 hours at such a critical time, right as you're approaching launch, because he's within a few, you know, 4 weeks of launch, I think is a big deal. Like, I think until you've proven your idea and people are actually paying you for it, I think investing 15 to 20 hours, that's if you're going to use Stripe's subscription API. I built mine in-house, where it's actually an internal billing executable. And all told, I outsourced a bunch of it. I did some myself. It was about 60 hours to build the engine, to integrate with Stripe, to figure it out, to get all the UI in place. I mean, it's a substantial amount of effort. And so if you're not able to outsource and you're not able to work on this full time, you need to think about if you're going to spend a month of your side project time rather than doing what I would essentially say is a stopgap measure. I mean, it's kind of a lean approach to go with one of these recurring billing systems. And I would say spend less time working on that stuff and more time getting your app out there and getting customers to buy. And if you have a big influx of paying customers, well, now you have money, or you're going to have time to go in and have the justification to actually build an actual billing system.
The other thing that I'll throw in here is that you don't have, if you go with Stripe, which is what I used for my Altieris training site that I talked about earlier today, you don't have to do everything all at once. So for example, in mine, in order to get things up and running very quickly, what I told the developer to do was essentially to create the billing integration and don't worry about all the other things such as being able to cancel and being able to do refunds and keeping track of the customers. The only thing I'm doing is keeping track of the customer ID that I get from Stripe. That's it. I don't really care. Everything else can be handled manually until I start getting enough customers where it is justifiable for me to spend additional time doing a lot of that other integration stuff.
Absolutely. I'm still at that point. My VA logs into my Stripe account to do refunds. My Stripe account is Hittail Stripe account. He logs in to do refunds. He logs in to do anything like that. There's no code written. I think I have the minimum amount of API calls just to make a charge on the Hittail site. So it's like two, maybe one or two API calls. And that's it. And so I agree. And I didn't, if you recall, I didn't build this billing engine until, I didn't actually get it live until like 2 days before the first 30-day trials were going to expire. right? So I actually had customers sign up for my trial, and they were going through the path, getting emails saying, hey, you're during a trial. And I did not have any type of billing in place at the time. And a contractor was building the engine, and then I QA'd it, fixed some stuff, and pushed it live about, it was less than 48 hours before the first billing needed to be done. So I totally think that's the way to go. I am not a fan at all of the old school merchant account providers like Authorize.net, CyberCash, Bank of America, Chase, any bank, stuff like that. They charge you fees out the wazoo. Typically, they'll say the monthly fee is $25. It's not that. It almost always winds up being $75 or more by the time they tack on all their garbage. The application processes take forever. There's no reason to do it in this day and age. Go, if you're in doubt, go with Stripe unless you have a compelling reason to do otherwise, like we've talked about here. You know, using the recurring billing systems would be the other option. Even these days, I don't recommend using PayPal like I used to. Stripe just, I'm in love with Stripe these days. They really are kicking butt. And aside from some very minor issues with international cards don't seem to go through as well on Stripe, and I've had some JavaScript problems with some, because they use JavaScript to get you around PCI, which is really nice. But I've had browsers with plugins, like Mac Chrome with X plugin, that basically means all the card keeps getting rejected, even though the card is valid. So aside from those minor issues, I can't say enough good things about Stripe.
So thanks for the question, Alan. And our next question is launch day tactics. And this question is from Kevin. He says, hey guys, listening to your last podcast, why it's easy to be great but hard to be consistent. I really appreciated your discussion on the fears of actually launching and how tempting it is to just keep working on the development side itself to postpone the big day. I was wondering if you guys could talk more about tactics and strategies for a smooth launch day. Additionally, could you discuss whether or not to do a beta test during the initial launch phase? Is it worth it to just go out there as is or spend some time testing first? Thanks, Kevin.
So I think we've covered the beta test, whether to do it during launch. I mean, it was 3-4 episodes ago. We kind of went to an in-depth discussion. But I do think it's worth discussing some ideas for having a good launch day. He asked about having a smooth launch day. I would say how to have a successful and profitable launch day. Smooth launch day implies that a lot's going to be going on and your servers are going to crash and bugs are going to be happening. And first of all, your servers are probably not going to crash from traffic. If they crash at all, it's going to be just bad luck. But the odds of you getting, you know, mad amounts of traffic that's going to take you down are pretty low. Some thoughts that I've shared elsewhere, I put them in my book, and I think we've talked about them before, about having a good launch day are not to think of it as a launch day, but to think of it as a launch couple of weeks. It's a launch process. And the thing is if you are building a product that people are ravenous to have, then you are going to have an easy time, and you definitely should build anticipation for your launch day. You don't, the worst thing you can do, and I see this over and over with sites I sign up for, I sign up for the mailing list, people get that first step. And then 3 months, 4 months, 6 months later, I get a single email from these guys that I've never heard from. And it's like, hey, we launched X app today. Come check it out. Click. And they don't give me any context. I don't even remember what the app does. Don't remember why I signed up with it. Don't remember how I heard about it. Anything, right? So I'm not excited to check it out at all. And they get abysmal conversion rates. You get abysmal conversion rates when you do it that way. What I would recommend is if you get the mailing list going, and then every couple of months, you update with a quick update, whether it's a short screencast, whether it's just a couple paragraphs. Hey, you know, you remember you signed up at this website. This is what the app does. Here's our progress. So you got to keep people in the loop every couple of months or else they lose it. Then as you build up to launch, you send an email about 2 weeks before your launch and you say, just giving you a heads up, we're almost ready to launch. Wanted to give you, since you're on the list, a sneak peek no one else is going to see. It's an exclusive thing, right? And you give them something cool, right? Something that's actually worth something, not just like a bunch of bogus marketing stuff, but like, here's some helpful info or a helpful screencast or something. And it also, of course, happens to relate to your product. And then about a week before, you say, all right, we're going to launch next week. And of course, you're on the mailing list. And we told you, you know, you're going to get something special, basically. You're going to get a discount for life on this product. We want to thank you for being part of the mailing list. And then the day before you launch, you say, hey, we're launching tomorrow. Gates open at this time. And basically, it's going to be like a 3-day or a 5-day thing. You should definitely come check the app out. And by this time, you've hopefully given them some information. You've given them testimonials from beta testers. You've built anticipation in their mind, shown them some screencasts, shown them some screenshots, where if you're building a product that people want, then they're really going to be chomping at the bit by now, because you've slowly dripped them some decent content that gets them excited. And then you do your launch day email. You say, you know, here you go. You get X percent off, whatever you're going to give these people. And for life, as long as you're a customer, you get this cheap rate. Everyone else will pay the high rate. And then on the day that it ends, 72 hours to 5 days later, you basically just say, all right, you know, there's only 8 hours left, just a reminder. And then this thing shuts down. And you shut it down. You don't allow people to sign up after that time at that rate. So I think that's the basic strategy.
The only other question he sort of asked was doing a beta test during the initial launch phase. And it's just really not a good idea to do your beta testing at the same time as you're doing your initial launch. I mean, you should really have a phased approach where you have some sort of a initial alpha or beta, and then maybe early access is kind of part of that, but you don't publicly open the doors to pretty much everybody on your mailing list. You kind of phase it out first just to kind of work out the major bugs, because people are going to run into, if you open it up to 25 people and there's a major showstopper bug, they're all going to run into it, and you're going to get 25 reports for the exact same thing. So put a couple of people on it, kind of work through what those issues are, put a few more people on it, work through whatever issues those other people come in with, and then just kind of work through them from there. And then once you get to the point where you have your early access, then things should be well enough along that all the major things are out, and that'll kind of contribute to your smooth launch day.
For our last question today, Juha wrote in and he asked how to get people to sign up to your pre-launch mailing list. In a recent episode, you talked a bit about pre-launch mailing lists. I would like to hear your ideas about what works in getting people to come to the site and sign up in those lists when I don't have a product yet. Should I already have short screencast screenshots at that point for them to come and check out? Thanks.
Well, I think this will be a pretty easy question to answer. I think you should go to the startupsrecipes.com website and look for episode 72. And that one is called 8 Tactics for Building Your Pre-Launch Mailing List. And we have a bunch of different things that you can use to help build up your mailing list. And I believe we talked about it in a previous episode as well. It was probably early on, maybe within the first 10 or 15 episodes, but we talked about mailing lists there as well. I guess to kind of summarize those, I don't think you need to have screenshots and screencasts, but I think you definitely need to have things that are calls to action. And I don't think you have to have a product either, but you definitely need to be able to clearly articulate the product that you're offering and that you want to build. And I would be hesitant to start talking about something that is going to take you a significant amount of time to build. If it's going to take you 8 months, 10 months, a year or two to build it, I don't think that going about just creating a mailing list is kind of the right way to do it. I mean, you should start talking to customers and working with people early on to build the product, as opposed to building a website to try and see if there's interest. I mean, those are two different strategies for building a product, and I think that you need to evaluate which one is more appropriate for it. But those are kind of my thoughts on it. I would definitely go back and listen to those other podcast episodes, because we talk a lot about the types of things that should go onto the website when you're trying to either build authority or build up that mailing list and convince people that they should be signing up for it.
Yeah, I think it depends on the niche, you know, where when you should build the landing page or take the more heavy customer development approach. So even if it's going to take you a year or two to build it, I would still put up a landing page. But in terms of the landing page early on, I think that a nicely designed landing page with one or two sentences that describe the very high level problem that your product solves and then has a single call to action to build the mailing list, I think that's probably the best thing. To not get into features, to not get into a bunch of bullet points, screencasts, screenshots, any of that stuff. Very early on, I think that works well. And if you have a very attractive screenshot, that can help. But if you're going to take 6 months to develop this thing, I would not spend a ton of time trying to spec it out, so to speak, and get a bunch of features onto the landing page. I feel like it just clutters it up. But I do feel like as you move towards the launch, you know, you check out how the page is converting. If it's converting well, I would just leave it. And if it's not converting very well, then I would think about, oh, people may need more information and look at creating either a nice screenshot, that's certainly going to be easier, or creating a 60-second screencast with the music in the background. And then either if you're a good narrator, you can do that, or you can just leave it as music. But I've almost found that kind of unprofessional screencasts, they will hurt your conversion rate more than anything. So unless you know what you're doing, I would lean towards having nothing or just having a screenshot. Go back, listen to episode 72 for more info.
If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsforrestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.